Hola, mi nombre es Miguel de Icaza y estás escuchando Look Radio.
I'm delighted to tell you this is not a conference special. This is not a bad quality audio version of Look Radio Live. It's not a marketing special. It's
Please
not a political
it's
special.
It's not a political special, yeah.
It is episode one of season five of Look Radio.
Yes!
We are back. Thank you very much.
Back in the saddle.
Thank the good man himself for being back.
We are back, and we are. Well, I am Stuart Langridge.
I am Jean-Noël Becon.
I am Adam Sweet.
And I'm the new boy, Chris Proctor.
Yes, welcome.
You are.
Welcome to
a
Chris
hairy
Proctor.
Age replacement.
Yes. I don't quite know how to take that, but move on.
Take it whatever way you like to take it, my friend.
Take it badly.
Is that a promise?
So, since we're on to season five, what are we going to talk about today?
I think we should have a look into the floorboards and do a bit of a mystery hunt.
That sounds exciting, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're going to talk to Miguel de Iguana de Icaza.
Yeah, I mean...
About Moonlight, about his
We talked to him, the spat with Simon Phipps. Did you know, I mean, he didn't say... I spoke to Simon after his performance in London a while back, and he didn't say anything about the problems that are with Miguel, you know, which is a bit weird. But we talked to Miguel about that nonetheless.
I do a slightly knobbly review of the Nuros LSD and the GP2X.
And Ack shows his wrongness by telling us that server stuff is hard.
No, hang on. Yeah, I show my rightness by server stuff is hard. But what do you mean, performance?
You what?
What's Hungry Fippo's been doing now? Performing
Hungry Fippo's. You know, he's doing theatre stuff now.
Really?
What?
You didn't read about it?
Don't think so.
Yeah, he contacted me a while back saying that he's... I know that for a while he's been doing drama, he's had a very strong interest in drama, but he's got the leading role in the London production of Spamalot.
Oh, really? The Monty Python thing?
Yeah.
No, you're right. It was on one of the... Someone.
I think it
someone's
was on,
bloody blog at
like
Sun
Rich Burridge's blog or something like that. But yeah, and yeah, I went along and he got me some tickets, which was quite nice of him, and I went to see him and he was very, very good. He was very... convincing King Arthur. So,
excellent.
Fippo the clown who's treading the boards.
Although this is presumably why we haven't got open source Java finished yet. So come on, Simon Phipps, pull your finger out. Less treading the boards, more open source Java,
that's
if
what
you
we'd
please.
Like.
The other thing we're going to talk about is we have confirmed dates for Lug Radio Live in the USA in 2008.
Yeah, that's coming towards the end of the show. So get excited, Lug Radio rednecks.
And welcome to season five.
So, Chris Proctor's a new man on the show, right?
Yep.
And I think it's safe to say he's a bit of a fucking gimp.
Agreed.
Harsh but fair.
Right?
I don't know, I think, but you know.
I don't know what you're laughing about, Adam Sweet. I expect this boot is descending in your direction as well.
And I was going to say, you know, I think one of the many reasons for Chris's gimpness is the fact that he's deeply interested in servers.
I don't think that's gimpy.
But I have a question. And I know the fat ginger man to my right also has a similar question.
Yes.
Why the fuck is server stuff so difficult? I mean...
It's not, you're just incompetent.
There is some backing to this, in the fact that... and all hackers should put their fingers in their ears right now and sing to themselves, but Ack and I run a server.
Be afraid, people, be afraid.
It's beyond bad, to be honest. And
note to crackers, no, it isn't.
You keep the cracker thing going, I'll tell the truth. And we set up this horrifically insecure email system.
Yes.
Keep the cracker thing going.
Go on. No.
But yeah, we just find it so difficult. And server stuff, it should be easier. I mean, you know... graphical interfaces have existed for the last 20 years.
Well, you see, there's the thing, Christopher Proctor Esquire, right?
P. Proctor.
There used to be...
Chris P. Proctor.
there used to be a kind of a feeling that that in the free software community, in the Linux community, there was an attitude of, well, you know, if you're finding it difficult, that's because you're not clever enough, and we don't want plebs, we only want clever people in our community. And then the desktop has gradually broken that down. We've said, no, it is reasonable to make things available.
Yeah, what you don't want is top trumps with fucking grep switches.
Yeah, you know, the whole point was to try and break it down and say, no, we don't want this kind of elitist atmosphere, but it's happened a lot less on the server. Do you think it's reasonable to be elitist on the server?
Yeah, kind of. I think part of the reason it hasn't happened on the server, though, is not so much that it's where server people are elitist. It's just that server people are really, really conservative. Like, you invent something now, 10 years' time, you might get it adopted widely in the server world.
When you say really, really conservative, does that mean you hate the common man?
We hate the common user.
This is actually true.
Right. That's the truth, actually.
So from the question, why is server stuff really fucking hard? You wouldn't dispute the question. You're not saying server stuff isn't hard. Saying it is hard and it should be.
I don't think it's hard at all. I'm a Linux sysadmin, as you probably know by now.
I don't think being ginger's very hard either. You know, you three would find it quite complicated.
To me, right, I can't program for shit. I find programming really hard. Admittedly, I've never spent enough time doing any programming to learn enough about it to say, yeah, if next time I want to program something, I can just do it. But for me, being a Linux sysadmin is just my area of specialism. I could have chosen another area of specialism. And I don't find it hard at all.
I think that's a reasonable point. You know, you guys do other stuff. You know, there are some people out there who hack on the kernel and they're really fucking good programmers.
But why do
other people are really good sysadmins.
But why, it's not why do you need to be a sysadmin to operate a server?
Yeah, I mean,
you basically need training to operate a server.
If I want to receive email, right, I think I'd like to receive some emails. That would be handy.
Understatement of the fucking century.
It's
receiving emails is a desktop thing.
It's really no.
Email servers slightly more complicated.
Yeah, but that's the point. I mean, essentially, what you'd say then is no, bugger off and use Gmail and have someone else be a complicated sysadmin for you. Mm-hmm. You know, is that the
difference between just receiving emails though? Is you're receiving one set of emails for one person. Whereas if you're doing a mail server, you can be running, you know, for thousands of users, you can be trying to deal with hundreds of, hundreds of thousands of emails in a day, in an hour. You know, it's a sense of scale.
Well, no, I mean, I understand that there's a difference between running a mail server for 4,000 users and doing it on the desktop. But if I would like to be able to read my email from two places, right? Hmm. I'd like to be able to read it from work and from home. There has to be a server.
I think
now I've got around this problem by using Gmail at the moment. But if I want to run my own server, I'm not interested in having a server that can do 5,000 people. But there's no easy way for me to just set up a mail server and have it work. I have to understand MX records and procmail and mailboxes and queues and what happens if a mail bounces and mail loops and everything. It's all really fucking hard.
I mean, the thing is as well is that, I mean, I don't know whether this is an inaccurate statement, but if you look at, Adam mentioned programming, right? I mean, I'm an equally shit programmer, right? No, don't know a lot
about
programming.
Probably less shit than me, to be fair.
But in terms of programming's got easier in some ways, in the fact that, you know, years ago, if you wanted to do programming, you had to really learn C or something like that. And now, programming languages have developed which cut a lot of the donkey work out of programming to a degree, and people have developed interactive environments, so rapid application development environments, and things like that.
That's also happened in servers, though. I mean, if you've ever looked at sendmail is the equivalent of C, with all the easy bits taken out. but then you get like, seriously, it's just mad.
It's pretty horrible.
Postfix and XIM and whatever are easier to set up.
But XIM is still fucking complicated.
Well, yeah, I mean, I accept that XIM's easier than sendmail. But it's like saying sendmail is like running a mile in 10 seconds, which is really hard. So we've made it easier. So now, XIM, that's like running a mile in 15 seconds, right? It's easier, but it's still really fucking hard.
Right. Another classic.
And you want to be able to do it at the mile in 10 minutes with a fag break halfway along.
DNS is really fucking hard. Why haven't the corners been knocked off this kind of thing?
The thing is, with mail and DNS are probably the two of the most detailed topics of any sysadmin's jobs. I mean, boring stuff that I care about that you don't, like SNMP, is actually pretty easy. And server monitoring and making sure your machines are up without actually just having to go and check and ping the box every 15 minutes. You can setting up all that kind of shit is actually not that hard. But mail and DNS are kind of complicated. And I was listening to the show from fucking eons ago where you were talking about partitioning. And there's no way to make a complicated subject easy. I think your canonical example I remember from a LUG meeting ages ago was, why is DNS so hard? Why can't it just be a hosts file?
Yeah.
And that's because where in your host file do you put that mail for this domain goes in this direction? or if it bounces from that machine, it ought to go to another machine.
So it's just an inherently difficult problem. I mean, to take your programming analogy, Jono, newer programming languages are easier. So you can use Ruby instead of C. And it does, it takes away a lot of the donkey work. But having Ruby doesn't make it easier to make Google, for example. Because the actual hard thing is the algorithm, the way of thinking, not the programming stuff.
The analogy was mainly in the fact the idea that, well, it's complicated, so therefore we shouldn't bother.
Is email like that? It's just an inherently hard problem. It doesn't feel like it should be an inherently hard problem.
Doing it right is quite hard.
It's more complicated than it first looks. It's like one of these, there were a lot of edge cases, essentially. Yeah, yes. Sending a mail from here to there, point to point, easy. Yeah. Not getting mailing loops, making sure everyone knows where they're sending it to and all that kind of stuff.
Mail's a pretty inexact science, because I remember setting one thing up. I got sick of all the having loads of spam. I ended up implementing greylisting, but I discovered a load of really strict checks on spam, and anything that wasn't RFC compliant, I started bouncing. We got no mail, because everybody else in the world's fucking stupid and doesn't do what they're supposed to.
Postal's law. So your answer to why server stuff's so fucking hard is because that's the way it is. No, it is hard.
The thing is, most of it isn't actually that hard. It's just I've invested enough time to understand all of the things that's involved.
Yeah.
As I said, SNMP is not a complicated thing. You just send a request and you get the response, and then what you do with it is up to you. You can graph it, you can do what you want. But mail and DNS are more complicated scenarios, and you can't make those easy for people without it being broken.
But I'd say part of the reason behind myself asking the question is that I do believe that there's a certain amount of, well, we can assume that most of the people who are going to be using this server software are pretty technical people anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So therefore, it's kind of like, well, we don't really need to think as hard about making things easy to use.
Yeah.
Whereas with the difference with desktop stuff is that it's fundamentally designed for people who aren't technical. So therefore, people have to think more intrinsically at these different levels. And the other thing is that there seems to be a certain amount of snobbery with sysadmins in the fact that I'm not going to use that because I'm fucking nails.
There is an element of that. But I think you miss out. There's you can design stuff for desktop and, yeah, you make it really easy to use and it runs like a dog, but who cares? You know, because only one person's using it and they can put up with it because it's easy to use. Whereas you can't do that with mail servers, for example, because they have to be able to cope with fucking tons of mail. So you can make it really, really easy to use, and it would send one mail every 10 minutes.
Why can't you just put? Why can't I just take a machine that runs some software and say, "This is my domain name. These are the usernames that I want." Make it work.
You're going to get spammed out of existence.
People have built like appliances, kind of. So here's buy this box, and it's an inbuilt mail server. Right. All you have to do is, you know, Cobalt used to do that before Sun bought them out and trashed it. But
right,
you know, people don't.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the key point about it really is that if you say, I want to be able to do this server stuff, people say, well, that's too hard, so you should use a service that someone else has provided, like Gmail, like ZoneEdit for DNS. But all you're doing is you're just taking the hard sysadmin stuff and giving it to someone else to do it. No point is anyone trying to eliminate the hard sysadmin stuff. You just find someone more competent to do it instead.
Well, in a way, what I was going to say about there's no way of making a hard subject easier is the fact that you've got to, if you want to do this kind of thing, you're going to have to invest some time understanding what you're doing. You can't just you can't have a Windows PC and just turn it on and have it work. It's not that easy. You can't just click the button and make it go. You've actually got to customize the details of what it's doing.
Okay, on the show now we've got Miguel de Casa. How are you doing, Miguel?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you doing, General?
Everything's great. So, welcome to Look Radio again. Tell us what you've been working on recently.
Well, recently I've been working hiring people to work on the Moonlight project. But just before that, I was working with my team in implementing Silverlight for Linux and bringing it to Linux computers, and that has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And you know, the usual Mono hacking.
Excellent.
I manage a team of people working on Mono, so that's what I do every day.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, obviously, there's been some. There's been a little bit of a controversy on your blog recently. You know, you've been firing some people up. So, just give us an overview of the post that between yourself and Simon Phipps and what's that random pundit? Oh, Matt Assay. That's right. Yeah. So cover us on that.
No, I don't think it was that interesting. What happened basically is that Simon Phipps said something along the lines of Miguel's implementation of Moonlight would bring people on other platforms, macOS and Windows, to accept these terms on the end-user license agreement for Silverlight. And he kind of analyzes the end-user license agreement, and I mean, it's not worse than any other end-user license agreement, but he kind of came down negatively on that. It's not any worse than any of the other end-user license agreements that people go through for stuff like Real and Java and Flash and all of that stuff. But it didn't really matter because he was reading the Microsoft Windows EULA. The EULA, I mean, we don't even use that for Moonlight. Moonlight uses the LGPL. So it was kind of his point was basically participating in that ecosystem forces people into some ugly EULA. But it's a EULA that is not, it's no worse than any of the other EULAs on proprietary operating systems. And kind of my point is, well, if you're really concerned about those EULAs in other operating systems, why are you using proprietary operating systems in the first place? Why are you not using Linux? So, I mean, you know, it's a stupid discussion on a blog, and I mean, it didn't really go anywhere other than, we found out that the MPEG-LA terms, which are the things that he didn't like the most, they're actually part of anything that uses QuickTime or H.264, whatever is the number. And you have to agree to that when you install an OS X machine to begin with. So it seems like, I mean, it seems like a storm in a teacup. I don't think it was really that interesting of a discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest with you, you made your point quite effectively. There was, you know, some people seem to be confusing Silverlight and Moonlight, and you were quite clear about that, and that was quite reasonable. Talking about Silverlight as a thing, do you think Silverlight is a good idea, rich internet applications generally, or do you think we should stick with, you know, the web as we currently have it?
I just wanted to say one thing. I really like Simon Phipps, and I have to say he was incredibly gracious in my blog when a lot of people kind of pointed out the errors, and he kept updating his thing. So I just wanted to say I have no beef with Simon. I think there's a little bit of competition going on between Simon's group and myself, you know, .NET versus Java. So I think it's all in good spirit. So now, that being said, we were interested in Silverlight not much from the perspective of do we really need this thing or not, in terms of a developer platform. But my position was pretty much the same that we had with Mono, which is if Silverlight becomes successful and it's adopted in a bunch of websites, what does that mean for Linux users? Do we Linux desktop users are going to end up again not having access to a blob of content and basically get a limited experience of what the world looks like? I mean, are we going to continue to be third-class citizens? So although Silverlight was something that Microsoft had announced like a year before, we didn't really, I mean, we felt, well, somebody is going to have to do this, but it doesn't have to be us because really it doesn't really have any relationship with what we do with Mono. But then a year later at Mix in Las Vegas, they announced an updated version of Silverlight. And this updated version of Silverlight actually took advantage of .NET and C# and the Iron Python and Iron Ruby and the dynamic language runtime. And that's when it resonated with us, because at that point it's like, well, this is now kind of stepping into our domain, right? We have the expertise in there, so it's the kind of thing that now it's something that we should seriously look into doing. And I like the technology. I mean, just from a geek or hacker perspective, it was something that looked interesting. So we said, well, maybe we'll look at that. And what happened is that at the Mix conference, kind of a rogue element in Microsoft, Marc Jalabert, who happens to work for Microsoft France, said, well, why don't you come to our event and talk about Mono, right? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that's going to go anywhere. But Mark kept pushing and said, hey, why don't you come to our event, and I'll try to get you into the keynote. I'll try to get you a session or something. For years, we kind of have been Microsoft has kept us away from their conferences and not giving us any spots. So I thought, well, that is a pretty cool opportunity. So he said, well, why don't you show something? Can you show Silverlight? Like, we had nothing done, you know, zero done. So we felt, well, maybe this is something we can put together. And we put together a prototype of Silverlight in 21 days. And that's where it all stems from. So from that perspective, I mean, our objective was we don't want to be third-class citizens as Linux users, you know, just like the recent iPod thing. We don't want to be third-class citizens. We want Linux to be a first-class player on this desktop space.
I can certainly see the argument. It's quite a pragmatic argument, to be honest with you. And I imagine it was a really interesting, you know, challenge hacking on it over the course of 3 weeks. I just wonder how, if you look at the web as a whole, not things like Silverlight or Apollo or all these kinds of things, but the web as a whole and the move to the web has been pretty good for Linux users because we've got web browsers.
Yeah, correct.
So how much of a responsibility is there on us to try and make sure that the web stays with this kind of open technology? Or do you think that what you're doing with Moonlight is making sure that even if Microsoft didn't want Silverlight to be open, it is anyway, because there's the Mono implementation?
Yeah, I mean, well, that was our position. We didn't think that we could convince Microsoft to work with us. We felt that it was something that we should do. We put together this hackathon just because we could demo it at a conference. And then it turned out to be something interesting. And then my boss's boss went to Microsoft and said, "Hey, why don't we work on this together?" So that's how it came to be. So I'm actually glad that that now we're working with Microsoft, because we get access to their test suites to guarantee not only that we have an implementation, you know, because like what happens with all of the Linux stuff or open source software is like, well, it's kind of good, but is it really that good, or does it have any bugs? And in a way, they're going out of their way to make sure that our implementation is completely conformant with their implementation. It's an open source implementation of the same technology. So, I'm sure that they have their own motives, which are completely unaligned with my motives. But, I mean, in the end, we meet in the middle. You know, they need to have a Linux story. We need to have access to that. So, I mean, there's something for each party to win here.
Fair enough. I was going to ask, I mean, this is the second, Moonlight is the second of these sort of slightly controversial kind of projects from a political point of view. Is there a line that you wouldn't cross with them, or is it all just about the technology? Is it purely a technical issue, or is it a, you know, is there any politics that you...
deem suitable?
Yeah. Is there any political line Microsoft have put in that you would then say no further?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question because I missed the first part. Would you mind repeating it for me?
So, well, so far you've done Mono and you've done Moonlight, both of which have been re-implementations of Microsoft technologies, and they've both been controversial in the open source community for exactly that reason, really. And I was just wondering if there was any line that you wouldn't cross, anything where Microsoft, you know, in their license agreement or in any of their kind of in any of the politics that went with these things, where you wouldn't cross that line, where you'd say I'm not interested in doing that one because Microsoft have done something, or is it just in technology? Is it just that's a good technology?
I think that there are a lot of variables. One of them is from a purely technological perspective. As you know, I like the .NET technology, and that's why I got interested in it. I can tell you right away that I wouldn't work on a COM implementation or an ActiveX implementation because I found the subject incredibly tedious, boring. Uninteresting. So that's one line I'm not going to cross. If it doesn't interest me, I'm not even going to go there. It's like there's a lot of things in life that I just don't care enough. Like, I don't know. I bought a book on UML and I got bored on the second page. So there's some of that. There's other things I don't know, there's a bunch of APIs that Microsoft defines for their own products, and we have no interest in those. We think that that we have better APIs in some cases. A lot of the Mono direction, although Mono originally was just the ECMA core and GTK, kind of as time went by, it became obvious that that we could help a lot of people move to Linux if we implemented some APIs. So we implement some things even if we don't like to. Like right now people are asking us, when are you going to have click once? And I don't really care about click ones myself. But, you know, if it's going to help us bring another, I don't know, 40, 50, 100 ISVs to Linux will implement it. So I'm not completely opposed to bad APIs. I'm just it's just something that we have to decide. We're not a gigantic team. We're 30 people right now, and you have to pick your battles. So that's how I do it. As for other kind of lines that I wouldn't cross, I mean, I think that my heart is pretty much where everybody else is. I mean, I believe in free software, the GPL, you know, the nice. Four freedoms, the basic things that everybody has to get, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm kind of in the same boat as everybody else on that matter. I'm just probably not as fundamentalist as some people are. But yeah.
Indeed.
I've got a soft spot for fundamentalists. A separate question. This isn't particularly about Mono and Microsoft or about mm-hmm. Moonlight and Silverlight. It's more about the free software community generally. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the free software community is as good a bunch of hackers, as innovative, as competent, as the large proprietary software houses? Microsoft, Apple, Oracle, whoever.
Well, I don't think that we lack ideas. I mean, if you sit down with everybody, and they don't have to be software programmers. If you sit down with anyone that is using a computer, they will tell you, wouldn't it be nice if, and then they give you a list of 100 things, and they might be very innovative things. So I don't think that lack of ideas is what's holding open source back. We have plenty of ideas, and I would say that proprietary software companies, Microsoft, and Apple and a bunch of others, they have copied time and time again ideas that they did not invent. And they copied some ideas that were first implemented as open source. They copied ideas from competitors. They copied ideas from other universes. So this idea that there's a single company innovating or there only a few people can innovate, I think it's complete crap. But it seems that that marketing and some messages keep driving that message. And I think it's complete nonsense.
So
innovation, everybody can have tons of ideas over dinner and give you hundreds of ideas of things you should do. The issue is whether you can execute on those, whether you have the resources to go from concept to implementation, you know? And I think that, I was talking to Nat the other day about that. I think that one of the beauties of a startup company is that you start with an idea and you think, well, I'm going to change the world with this idea. And as you develop the idea and people start using your idea, you realize that although that was your idea, the direction that you were going into isn't really that interesting. But there are some other uses for your technology, and you kind of start doing a course correction. You know, So the market or your customers or your users start to course correct your direction, and you end up with some really interesting stuff.
Sure. Indeed.
So as I said, I think it's a matter of execution. There's thousands of ideas, but there's kind of a big gap between having the idea and actually shipping a product, you know, not only implementing it, but shipping it and making it reach users. And from that standpoint, I think that proprietary companies or startups or well-funded groups of developers tend to have better chances than just a couple of guys working on their spare time on making something happen. So definitely being funded and being able to work on your idea full-time will bring the innovations to the table. And I don't think innovation is limited to Apple or Microsoft. It's just, and they've copied a lot of things from us. So I don't think that proprietary companies have an advantage over us. It's just, in terms of coming up with ideas, it's just when it comes to execution, we have an issue.
Sure. I'd just like to ask you something slightly different, actually, Miguel. I believe the GNOME desktop was 10 years old recently.
Yeah.
And of course you were there at the very beginning. And in the beginning there was Miguel. So obviously we're 10 years on down the line now. I just wondered, first of all, how you think it's gone over the first 10 years and perhaps where we might be in the next 10 years.
Oh, I'm very bad at predicting. See, if I was good at predicting, I would not be in this industry. I would be playing the stock market. But I can't be happier. I mean, it's been fantastic. Of course, 10 years ago, we thought that it would take 2 years for GNOME to take, or Linux for that matter, to take over the entire world. And I think that history has corrected us there. Taking over the world actually takes a lot more work. But, you know, now Linux is considered a real operating system that people can deploy in governments, in companies, and, all around the globe. And not only for places where you're trying to save money, but, banks, banks that sell trillions of dollars, you know, and they have huge revenues, are adopting Linux in droves. So, I mean, it's not the 99.99% that we thought we could get in 6 months, you know, 10 years ago. But it's moving pretty well, and you know, it has branched into a lot of things. There's all kinds of other efforts that like the OLPC and you know, the MIMO platform and all of those things. So, I mean, it has really gone beyond the very basics, and that sounds pretty sweet.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being a key member in that community, and thanks for coming on Log Radio, Miguel, and we hope to speak to you soon.
Thank you so much, guys.
Brilliant. Take care, Miguel.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye. Bye.
Chris?
Yeah?
You found it yet?
No. You?
No. Where the fuck is it?
Can't find it anywhere. You guys?
Hang on. Oh, no. Hang on. It might be... no, there's a load of stuff here. I've got the easel business plan. I've got Sco's evidence they own Unix. No, it's not. There's loads of missing stuff, but not... Jono?
Yep.
Have you found it yet?
Not exactly.
Where are you?
Scared.
Where are you looking?
Scared.
Where are you looking?
Rises basement.
Have you found anything?
Not exactly.
Where the fuck is Zool?
So what has happened to Zool, then?
Don't know. It's clearly not where we were looking. Do you think we're going to win an Emmy for that?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, where is it? I mean, Zool's always supposed to be this big promise that it was going to was going to revolutionise applications.
Let 1,000 browsers bloom.
And yeah, and you know, people were sort of saying it was going to be the open source equivalent of Oh Camel, do.
Impressed from the Jinta corner over there.
I'm not impressed because you don't know what Oh Camel is.
Oh Camel!
That would be a lot funnier if it wasn't the fact that what you mean is XAML.
XAML!
Oh Camel is a programming language. Zool was never meant to be its equivalent. You're a fucking moron.
The gag was more important.
Apparently.
So yeah, anyway, there are, three things that use Zool. There's Mozilla.
There's Firefox, Thunderbird, and Songbird.
Firefox, a pointless media player, and the Mozilla Amazon browser.
Thunderbird is Zool application.
That fucking dropped from the Mozilla Foundation.
Is this what we spent three years reinventing the wheel for after Netscape was open sourced?
Well, the interesting thing from my perspective about Zool is that they were positioning it, or they used to position it at least, as the way to develop cross-platform applications. That it would make it easy for everybody to build apps that would work across lots of different browsers. And broadly, the Mozilla Corporation are starting to step away from it. They're not suggesting that they don't use it for their projects, but there's been a lot less in the way of pushing it to other people as a platform to use.
Yeah. I just wonder why. I mean, it seems, as a technology, it makes sense, you know? I mean, I tried using it, and it was fucking hard. It was like root canal surgery, you know, trying to use Zool to build an application that was not useful for just displaying Amazon content.
Are we talking about applications inside a browser, or are we talking
about applications?
Is that the Zool Runner thing? So you can...
Zool Runner is kind of a runtime, I suppose. The idea is that it's something which knows how to run a Zool application, but doesn't do any of the application logic. So Firefox, for instance, could be built on top of the Zool Runner, and the plan was. That it would be.
Because I like the idea of rich internet applications that use widgets, actual desktop widgets. Mm-hmm. I quite like the idea of that. And Zool, that's what I originally got interested in Zool for. I wrote a series for this format.
Kind of pre-Ajax.
Everyone's starting to use Ajax. So
you're talking about their applications inside a browser, things blurring the boundary between browser applications.
Or even applications that are sourced from the internet that appear that don't appear like a browser. So like there's like the Mozilla Amazon.
Like the Mozilla Amazon browser, as
but
an example.
It's a shame really that it's kind of gone nowhere. Because a lot of people were kind of, and I just wonder what does anyone know? I mean,
where the fuck is Zool?
Where the fuck is Zool? You know, I mean,
the way it stands at the moment is that the Mozilla Corporation have, I don't know the best way to describe it, have outsourced the Zool Runner, I suppose. They said, we're not devoting significant more paid Mozilla time to it. It's going to the community to maintain. We still think it's a good idea, but we're not going to dedicate loads of effort to it in the same way that they cut off Thunderbird.
Pissed me off, that did.
Well, yeah, but they're now yeah. they Thunderbird is different because they've now spun off a company like yes. they did with Firefox to deal with Thunderbird.
That cheered me up again.
But what I don't know is I don't think you get anybody at the Mozilla Corporation to admit this, but I suspect Zool didn't fulfil the promise that they'd hoped for it. They were hoping that lots and lots of people would take it up, and the fact that we can only name not even a handful of Zool applications which aren't from Mozilla.
No, some spud's going to write in and say,
actually, I developed a Crystal Space implementation in Zool.
Well, I mean,
is there an IDE from Active State that uses
there Zool? Is. Yeah. And I've
a language that doesn't have an IDE from Active State.
I built an application at work in it. And well, one of the reasons I did that was because I wanted an app which would run on a CD, run from a CD, wouldn't require any installation step. On this was on Windows, but it wouldn't require any installation step at all. So you wouldn't need to run it and then install runtimes for your thingy. But that we could build it. You could write a C application to do that, but we can't do C. So
why would you? Why, as someone who's done them both, then why do you normally do things in GTK rather than in Zool?
I mean, because I am primarily writing Linux applications.
But why don't you write them in Zool? I mean, what's wrong with Zool that means you would much rather use GTK or whatever?
There are two things wrong with Zool. First of all, there's no Glade, which makes building a Zool application a pain in the arse. In exactly the same way that building a HTML application is a pain in the arse, you've got to think about it. But it's like learning a whole new dialect of HTML. So there's that. But the second thing is that the underlying layer, the XPCOM layer, the bit which actually does work, like open files and talk to the network and so on, is this horrible, crawling, complicated nightmare. I mean, the idea was that they would build kind of abstraction layers on top of it. So there'd be an easy... To do something really simple, like read a file from the file system, you have to create a component with a huge, long name and then invoke the component's instantiate method and then use that to browse to a particular, and it's just a nightmare. What you want to be able to do is do file.open, you know, like in Python.
The idea
behind it was that people would build, you know, that was just a really low level thing, and say, well, the C API is a really low level thing, and then people would build abstraction stuff on top of it. But because no one started using Zool, people didn't get into building these abstraction layers, and therefore new people don't get into using Zool. It's a chicken and egg problem, really.
Yeah.
If more people started, I mean, you'd probably find Songbird's got a lot of stuff involved in it to make all this kind of thing easy. And you could theoretically separate it out from Songbird and make it easy to write your application.
But the most important thing about Songbird, as has been discovered, is that it's got a very cool clip art bird. That seems to be prime importance. You read anything about Songbird, there's a different clip art bird. And when I'm talking about bird, I mean the animal, not...
I wanted to ask you one more question. If the Mozilla Foundation are quietly pushing this out the back door... where does that leave the browser's toolkits? Firefox. Is Firefox and Thunderbird and so on still going to be built on...
I can't think for the life of me why they'd abandon Zool at this point.
Yeah, no, they announced it today. Did you see? They're putting it to TickleTK.
Beard. I was thinking all the way through this, I don't believe this is going to be the truth, but you blew it with the tickle.
In fact, I'd say that's such an outrageous beard, that could almost be called comedy Arabian beard.
Fuck off, certainly.
But yes, so, they're still committed to it, absolutely, but so, I think they've basically abandoned the idea. They say if anybody else wants to use it, great, and we'll help you out and everything, and that's a good idea, but they're...
just not going to try and take over the world with it.
They no longer seem to want to be pushing it, or no longer have the resources to push it, to say other people should use this because we think it's good.
So, fuckers.
thank you.
Over the summer, I bought a couple of devices. Linux devices, more to the point.
Okay.
That kind of device?
No. Sorry, I've already got some of those. I'm joking. No, over the summer, after speaking to the people at Lug Radio Live, I went and bought a GP2X, and I also bought a Neuros OSD.
Okay.
And they are?
Neuros OSD is it's basically a kind of networked multimedia device. That doesn't narrow it down at all. Basically, you plug it into your TV, and you watch your...
So kind of like Apple TV, kind of thing.
Kind of like Apple TV. There's two main differences. First of all, there is no store to go and buy your media from. There's no wireless, and there is no local storage.
You're fucking selling it to me, mate. I'm sold.
Well, why do you need to go and buy... Well, maybe we'll talk about that later. GP2X is a Linux-powered handheld device. It's basically a game simulator.
It's really, really good for playing shit games.
It's a handheld games console, like a PSP.
Yeah, and there are games, native games for the GP2X, but also its primary selling point is the fact that you can run pretty much any emulator on there that has been ported to the GP2X.
It's cheap as well, very cheap.
Yeah. Emulators like...
UAE.
Which is the Amiga one.
Amiga emulators, the Commodore emulators.
MAME on it.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Sega emulators, Spectrum emulators, Commodore 64.
So it's for playing games from 15 years ago?
Yeah,
it's for that important demographic that's got a garage full of ROMs.
Well, which is basically me, because I absolutely adored my Spectrum, and I was still playing it probably 10 years ago.
I didn't realise you had a garage full of ROMs.
No, I don't have a garage full of ROMs. I copied all of the tapes that I owned on, and all of my friends that he gave me because he doesn't want them anymore.
Really?
Yeah. No.
Be it!
Moving on.
Moving on. Please cut that bit out. I just wanted to just say what I thought about those two devices.
Yeah, what do you think? Neuros one looks particularly interesting. Yeah. We've heard about the GP2.
I spoke to Joe Bourne from Neuros. And
who was at Lug Radio Live?
Yeah, he was.
Oh, Bourne again, yeah.
And I actually really liked what he said, because I know you talked about the Apple TV last season, and Aid was very impressed with it, and it's a fucking great idea, because I think we're all going to be doing that soon. But the thing I don't like about the Apple TV is, first of all, you're locked into Apple's hardware platform, Apple's software, and the DRM. And the Neuros doesn't have any DRM, as far as I'm aware. And you can play any media which you own. I don't have a problem with getting media from the Apple Store, because I don't want to buy it through the Apple Store.
Sorry, I don't quite understand. I went to the Neuros... When you wrote a blog entry about it, right?
Yeah.
And I went to look at the Neuros site, and I was looking through it. I still didn't quite understand what it's for. Give us an example of what you use it for.
The thing is, the reason why I bought it is because it fitted perfectly for what I had a need for. Because basically, I'm sick of carrying my PC out of the computer room into the bedroom, loads of fucking horrible cables, sticking it in the back of my telly, and then trying to work out why it's all in black and white.
Right.
And basically, the Neuros is, what, say, probably 20 centimetres or so in length, 15 centimetres deep,
it's about the size of a paperback book.
Yeah, it's tiny, and basically it comes with all the cables you need to plug into your TV.
Yep.
Which is a great benefit for me, because I'm sick of carrying the fucking PC from room to room every time I want to watch
it. Hang on, I'm still not clear. I'm still 100% clear on what it does.
It plays media. Is it video, YouTube music?
To your telly.
So you plug it into your telly, and then it basically allows you to stream content from your PC
and
watch it on your TV.
Or a USB disc or a flash card.
So it's essentially a device for allowing you to stream content to it, and that plugs into your TV.
Yeah, basically, it just plugs into your TV and plays whatever...
Just like Apple TV.
How does it stream things? Do you have to put a streaming server on your PC?
You can do it over Samba, you can do it over NFS, you can do it over...
So you've got to share it out somehow.
Yeah.
From your PC. Does it understand things like, I don't know, Rhythmbox's streaming server or...
It does UPnP, which is interesting because I didn't know what it was last time I was here. Me and Aid were arguing over the fact that we thought it was a fucking firewall
penetration thing. Is that among other things? Yeah. Right, okay.
Okay, interesting. And what do you think of the GP2X?
What do you think of the Neuros? Describe what it does.
Yeah.
Do you like, what do you think?
Is it a good execution of the concept?
It Well, it fulfills my needs perfectly, which is exactly why I bought it.
Goat pornography.
Well, there's no goats, certainly. sidestepping that particular landmine.
Just pornography. That's okay.
And other media. The main problem I have, first of all, is the fact that it came with an American plug, which pissed me off, but I managed to get an adapter. At the moment, half of the media I have, the playback video, is pretty choppy. There's stuff on the forums, and I've yet to decide whether that's just down to my network performance or whether it's just the decoding and display.
It's the device itself, right?
Yeah. There are a lot of people talking on the forums about that, and a lot of the Noros guys are there saying, well, if you send us the file, we'll have a look at it for you and work out what it is. Most people suggest it's not performance, it's just down to the firmware they're using.
Does this thing sit on the internet as well?
It's network addressed.
So has it got a means of updating the firmware when they fix stuff?
Yeah, you can update the firmware at any time you choose. You can choose to run stable, beta, or experimental. The other thing is there's a built-in YouTube viewer.
Now, that's cool. One of the main things I use my PS3 for and my TV is for when people come over and watching funny YouTube videos.
Yeah.
Well, we do it a lot, don't we?
So, dim question then. Does it have to know how to play the format of the movie? If I'd e.g. gone off to the internet and downloaded a movie in MP4 format or in XVID format or in Windows Media format or whatever, does the Neuros have to know how, presumably it has to know how to decode these files? So what can it decode?
As far as I know, it does MP4, MPEG, OGG, WMV, DivX, XVID. I asked Joe Bourne about this and he told me them all, haven't I?
So it plays most stuff.
Yeah, and
it's all open source anyway, so you'd always write the...
Well, that was going to be the next question. It's open source on there. Is it just basically, you know, a rather flashy looking box with an American plug and M player on it?
XMMS, I think.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I mean, the only thing I haven't worked out at the moment is whether the performances, some of the playback, not everything, is choppy because it's my network performance, or whether it's actually the decoding. Okay.
Do you think it's a...
I will be happy when I have playback going well on it. I'm going to try some videos by plugging it into a fucking USB disc into it and seeing whether that's the difference.
Yeah. It's a bit disappointing that it doesn't fucking play video very well.
Since that's all it's for.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I've been pretty disappointed, but I am confident that the solution is there when I get around to it. I haven't had a chance to try it in about a week.
Is it open source? The software?
Yes, completely open source, as far as I'm aware. And
Even things like MPEG playback?
I've no idea.
Oh, well, okay.
As far as I think the firmware is open source, and they are happy to talk to you about getting features.
Is there a community working on it, or is it all just coming from Neuros?
I don't know how much external contributions there are, but I know they're quite willing to talk to users, definitely, and say,
cool. So
if you want this feature, add it.
So give us a quick 2-minute summary of what you thought of the GP2X. Most people are familiar with what it is, but what do you think about it? Because not many people have said what they actually think about it in use.
Right. I mean, the first thing I wanted to say about both devices is the fact that I bought them because I wanted to support the kind of devices that I want, and I want to support them to do what I want them to do, if you know what I mean. The GP2X is a little flimsy to feel. The joystick controller thing is pretty shit, to be honest, so much so that they actually give you a second one when you buy it. And in all honesty, I played it for about 3 days and got bored. Which is unfortunate.
Hang on, did you get bored with the games that are available on it, or did you get bored with the GP2X itself?
I got bored with fiddling to get the controls correct to play the games I wanted to play in emulators. For example, I was played Barbarian.
Really?
And I just couldn't get it to do anything, and I played a couple of other games, and I couldn't get the controls to do what they were supposed to do. And I don't know whether that's a bug in the emulator or a bug in the hardware of the device itself, but it just didn't I just couldn't get it to do what I wanted it to do.
Do you know if there's going to be a GP3X?
I believe there is, actually, and I think they're looking at adding features that people are screaming out about at the moment.
Such as, like, game support.
Imagine that the GP2X did perfectly, basically everything it describes on the website, so there weren't bugs in it and the stuff will work, would it then be good? Is your problem just with the fact that it's buggy, or is the concept fucked?
I think the idea is pretty cool. I don't know whether the hardware's a little flimsy to the touch, as I said.
I thought it had two CPUs in it.
Yeah, it's got two ARM CPUs. I mean, I don't mean...
Yeah, that's pretty studly.
I don't mean the physical specifications. I mean, the actual device itself, you can kind of bend it and it kind of clicks and crunches a little. Which is a bit weird.
Shake it and it makes a rattling sound. Yeah.
isn't it immensely cheap, though, by comparison with other things like it?
It's about 100 quid.
You've got a PSP, Bacon. How much was your PSP?
I don't know. I bought it ages ago. Well, in the US as well. But they're about 200-odd quid.
Right, so it's about half the price. Not that they're necessarily equivalent devices.
Well, yeah. I think the reason why I bought it is because I used to love the game Match Day on the Spectrum. And it's got a TV out on it. And I believe that pretty much any USB joypad or joystick is supported in the USB port.
The one thing... I find, just wrapping up a little bit, the one thing I find a bit disappointing about this is that these are hardware devices that are produced in the open, with a strong open source grounding, and they sound buggy as fuck.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like for open source software, which is often renowned for its reliability and its stability.
It
just doesn't seem to fit,
Yeah. I mean, this is part of the reason why I wanted to talk about them, is because... Are they all going to be shit? I know there's more devices in the pipeline, and there have been devices in the past. Are they all going to be shit? Is there going to be a device where you just buy and it just works?
We never seem to be able to put it together, right? We never seem to get something and say, that's just excellent. There's always something. It always feels like it's a bit of a labour of love. It's there for people who want to be involved.
This is about the reason why... Sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, is that a release early, release often thing? If they just basically released early and give them a year, will it...
No, maybe they need to release later and fix the bugs first.
That's an open source thing, isn't it?
The idea behind release early, release often is, if you get into it early, then... Then you pay the early adopter penalty. Mm-hmm. But the problem is everyone pays the early adopter penalty, but then no one ever continues with the release early, release often process until it's good. You get three quarters way through and they start working on a new device. So no device ever actually bloody works properly.
This is part of the reason why I'm so cynical about OpenMoko. I know that there's a lot of work going into it, but how is this going to be any different, I hate to be kind of like the cynical bastard, but I'm going to be. How is it going to be any different to all of these other attempts at a something in your pocket that boots a kernel?
The thing about these two devices is, in my opinion, the reason why I haven't got them to do what I want them to do at the moment is because basically they are the desktop software that we use regularly. Admittedly, XMMS 2 nobody really uses anymore. I think we're all using Totem or whatever you want to choose. I think it's the same desktop software that from 5 years ago, but just shoehorned into a smaller device.
Yeah.
And not especially customized for what it's supposed to do. I mean, the Neuros, I believe, will actually be pretty good once I've managed to get around to upgrading the firmware and complaining that it doesn't do what I wanted to do
We should talk to some people about this with up-and-coming devices and see, because I'm sure there's a reason why they're so fucking buggy.
Yeah. If you're someone who works for a firm doing a Linux embedded device,
get in touch.
Drop us an email.
show@lugradio.org. Does that work now?
Yeah.
Just checking.
Thank you for all your emails you sent us over the summer. We had a nice summer break, and you've sent us millions and millions of emails.
We appreciate the fact that people do keep sending them in. So
keep sending them in.
Keep sending them in.
That's show@lugradio.org if you're not sure.
Bo Chicka, wow. Would you like to start my excessively large ginger friend?
I will do. Kevin Squire has written in.
Hello, Squire.
To say, I just heard you talking about the maximum distance someone could travel to get to Lug Radio, and it got me thinking. From what I figured, that would be approximately 12,450 miles, and then he goes into a load of stuff about how boring he is. Right. I was wrong. I get it. Shut up. Thank you very much, Kevin Squire.
Thanks, Kevin. You're a hero. We've had an email from Paul Sebastian Manhole.
What?
Yeah, Paul Sebastian... Oh, sorry.
Bullshit.
Manhole.
Paul Sebastian Manoli.
Have a large what?
Captain Manhole says...
Where is the poo commando now?
Ah, So he says, hello, I'm a relatively new listener to Look Radio. Okay, a very new listener, started in season 4, episode 17, through to episode 22. I know you got plenty of emails about how the audio files, about the audio files and the fact that you're all talking at the same time. For the latter, I must agree with the rest and say it's true that some of your listeners can't understand a word you guys are saying when you're all talking at the same time. That's only because it's a mono recording. Or some of your readers don't speak English native. I'd like to give you some advice, even if I already know it's not going to happen. Unless you people have really great hosting. I was thinking you could at least make the podcast in stereo and then virtually position each speaker. You guys must know what 5.1 virtual surround sound is and two channels.
Please, sir. I don't know what it is.
Please, sir, I don't care what it is.
I do websites, yeah. Me.
Basically, what it is it's a means of separating out the different voices in so different speakers can make use of them, and it happens on a lot of recordings that aren't Look Radio.
brought to you in glorious mono.
Or you could try real 5.1 channels and put Adam. Adam is the one with the low pitched voice, right, on the subwoofer channel. Just because you have an effect on the ladies. Thanks for the awesome show. You were right, Paul Sebastian Manhole. It ain't going to happen.
Manhole.
So, Bacon, since I know nothing about this, I assume there's a reason we don't do it in stereo.
I've actually been thinking recently about maybe releasing the shows in stereo. Mainly because a lot of people listen to the show on dodgy PC speakers. And if you position some of the voices in some of the channels, then they might not hear some of the channels if they've just got left or right plugged in. Whereas if it's in mono, you know that it's going to work well for everybody. And the separation really, it's only really audio files you really care about it to a degree. I mean, 5.1 is nuts. I mean, he's saying 5.1 on two channels, which is virtual surround sound. But and also, I'd like to edit the show in less than a week. So
okay, is it going to double the amount of
it'll make
disk
the files
space?
Bigger, I suspect, but I don't know how much bigger.
Well, it might be worth experimenting with.
Yeah, we might experiment with it. And that experimentation basically boils down to the fact that I don't try it and it doesn't get released.
I'm going to briefly interrupt to say Carl Latimer, the infamous car thief Carl Latimer, has written in to say that the circumference of the Earth is 24,859 miles, proving himself to be just as boring as Kevin Squire. But he says the maximum distance from anywhere on Earth to Lug Radio Live is 12,429 miles, rather than 12,450. So, Carl, Kevin, if you'd like to go and beat the shit out of one another and come up with one answer, let us know.
Just auto-negotiate and meet in the middle. I've got an email here from Derek Weber in Australia. That's pronounced Weber, but I'm going to call him Weber anyway.
belligerent shit.
Entitled, "Your hamster smelled of elderberries and your grandmother blows her nose." And he's just saying that so we can get us to read the email.
Is he really well experienced in incorrectly citing Monty Python?
Is that where it's from?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. There's me showing fucking ignoramus.
He will fart in your general direction.
Do you know what? My sixth form report, school said I was the class ignoramus. Unrelated.
Well, there you go.
Anyway, first of all, I'm going to paraphrase, but there are two things I'd like to say from this email. First of all, Derek Weber is quite keen for more length, apparently. But he's actually on a bad...
What?
I'm very keen for more length, but he's actually just talking about the show. Basically, he's going on about the fact that he drives to work and it's... He's not going to be able to attend Look Radio Live in the next 5 years. So he's very Derek Weber or Weber, if you're interested. Everybody, he's interested in more length. If you've got something to offer. and the other thing at the bottom, you say some other stuff, but I'm going to cut down to the bottom there. And he says, "Oh, and welcome to Adam, a great voice to add to the mix permanently. Although until I saw his photo on the web, for some reason I assumed he was a great big black guy like Lenny Henry or Lawrence Fishburne, who plays Morpheus in The Matrix."
That's couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah. I'm the
short pasty
shortest, pastiest white arsehole you've ever seen. Moving on.
"Dear Look Radio team, Django Reinhardt was from neither Spain nor France. He was Belgian. Now you know. Love and hugs, Brian Riley."
Wow.
Thanks so much, Brian Riley.
So Willison was like, no, he was French. Ah, fuck you, Willison.
You were wrong too, Bacon. I ought to point out.
But Willison was knowledgeable. He should know where bloody Reinhardt was from.
Why?
Because he's the co-author of Django, and he named it, didn't he?
No, I think Adrian named it. Anyway, moving on.
So that's three famous Belgians then.
Who were the other two?
Waffles.
Poirot.
Waffles. Right. As
funny names thing. We had a segment with people with stupid names, and someone called Chris Maggs obviously spent some time working as tech support for NTL, and every time someone with a stupid name crossed his desk, he wrote it down on a piece of paper.
One of life's winners, then.
Because there are plenty of people called things like Mr. Dong Dong and Mr. Samuel Wanky and Mr. Charlie Grewcock. Mr. Shithole, which I don't believe for a moment. Mr. John Low Blow, Mr. U Bender, Mr. Roger Hole, Mr. Mike Cockshot. It goes on and on and on.
Keep going.
Thank you very much.
Keep Chris. Going.
No, no, keep no.
It's the last one. We're not right. Doing these ridiculous
okay,
names.
Okay, there's, someone called, someone called Mr. A Shit Chowdhury. Mr. Paul Hiscock. Mr. Dong Dong. Oh, I said that one. Mr. John Butt. Honestly, this. Oh, Mr. Martin Harddick. Nice. Thank you very much, Chris Maggs.
Can I tell you about Dick Brain?
No way.
Apparently, and someone who I know someone called Dick Brain.
And what the guy, name. Have you heard of Skip, the identity company? They do a lot of open ID stuff, things like that. Bloke who runs their firm called Dick Hard. Honestly.
I've met him.
It's all true. Okay, thank you very much, Chris Maggs. How can I put this to you? We now consider this correspondence closed. Please stop sending us funny names.
Okay, we've had an email from Simon Smith, the world's unfunniest name. A distro too far, I saw Ubuntu CE and thought, cool, a compact edition. Little did I know it's Christian edition. Now I don't imagine any of you are born again God botherers.
Stick the boot in a bit, Smith.
All your Bible are belong to us.
But what is so unchristian about Ubuntu anyway? Take a look at www.whatwouldjesusdownload.com/christianubuntu/2006/07/about-ubuntu-christian-edition.html.
It's a snappy one, isn't it?
P.S. Can you manage to get a bit more swearing in the show? The boys at the Tourette support group love it.
Fuck munchers.
Yeah, thank you for that.
Fuck munch.
Can you? I've got one from Matt Ashton. Can you please dedicate a segment where you all do your very best American accents? I think
no.
We just,
no.
I think perhaps from earlier in the show, you probably realised what our acting skills are like. I think we better sidestep that fucker.
And Ravel's gone as well. He had marginal accent abilities.
Okay. Got an email from Andrew Kant, who's part of a group organising the Ontario Linux Fest in Toronto, Canada. Saturday, October the 13th.
Okay.
So I'm just pimping. He's just pimping
that. Pimpage!
www.onlinux.ca. So
wicked.
If you're
get
interested,
along.
Go and have
excellent.
A look.
Mm. Excellent. So that's it, yeah?
Yep.
Good. Let send you your emails to show@lugradio.org and we'll possibly read them out. If not, we'll bin them. You three have gone very silent. You're all looking at me as if I've just...
Everybody else went quiet, so I just kept quiet too.
Sheep.
Sorry.
Those of you who are at Lug Radio Live or have listened to the broadcast and could get past the fact the audio was shite may have noticed that we're having Lug Radio Live in the USA.
Yes. Woo-hoo! Oh, yes.
And we were
Freedom
a bit,
Radio Live.
We were a bit reticent about announcing dates because we didn't know them at the time, and now we do.
We do.
So, American listeners, Lug Radio Live, USA, will be...
It's the 22nd and 23rd of
March 2008 in San Francisco.
Yes, indeed. At the DNA Lounge.
We're going to be holding it at the DNA Lounge because we're just that trendy. So, that's Easter weekend.
Yeah.
The problem is, it's Easter weekend, but the good news is for you, you're all geeks and you don't like other people, so you'll choose Lug Radio Live.
don't
way
choose
to
Jesus.
Alienate the listenership.
Yeah. Don't choose Jesus, choose us.
So yeah, so it's going to be unbelievable. We can't tell you too much stuff about it right now because we're still in the planning stages, but
yeah,
rest assured, it's going to be fucking sweet. I mean, we've...
Keep your eye on lugradio.org and there'll be news.
Yeah, absolutely. The all new lugradio.org.
And we are hoping that we'll be able to meet an awful lot of you when we're over there.
Yes,
so
absolutely. Yeah.
We're not sure exactly how many tickets there are going to be either. This is another one of these things we don't quite know yet. But when tickets go on sale, snap them up quick.
Yeah, you're going to want to snap them up quick because we suspect there's going to be a lot of demand because San Francisco is a pretty tech-savvy area. So there's going to be a fair few locals coming down and obviously there's going to be people travelling to come. So,
okay, Americans, if you're planning on going to Lug Radio Live in the US, drop us an email and tell us that you're coming.
Absolutely.
First show in the can.
Absolutely.
It's been fun.
First show on the can.
Speak for yourself.
So, yes, those of you who didn't download this from an RSS feed, did you like the new website?
Oh, it's very spanky, isn't it?
Sexy. It is. We ought to say thank you very much to Mike Evans,
who's
our designer. He's done the designs for Lug Radio Live for the last couple of years.
Also,
and he designed the website, and it's beautiful. Thank you, Mike. It's very cool work.
It's. We'd also like to say a big thank you as well to Scott Thompson, my old boss, who did all the photos. We went and posed in Birmingham for a day. It was good fun, and we've been trying to kind of raise the bar a little bit in the design, and we're really proud of what. Both Scott and Mike have managed to produce. Yeah,
very grateful.
Yeah. And well done, ACK, for the CSS, incidentally. I mean, ACK took the design from Mike and produced something that looks identical but actually works.
That's the goal. I did debate just making it one huge, great, big GIF with an image map over the top of it, but the accessibility people complained to me for the idea.
Something you guys need to look at when you go to that website, you'll see there's a new section in there called Live. And in that section, there is some information about how you can book Lug Radio for live performances. One thing we've been wanting to do is to go out and do live shows.
Bar mitzvahs.
Weddings, funerals, really.
Lunchtime in the pub will do.
Absolutely. We were actually lined up to present the Oscars this year, but then that bastard Billy Crystal came back from holiday and so we lost the gig.
Yeah, so... Yeah, so this is something we've talked about for a while. Various people who listen to the show have asked us to go to their lugs and things like that, and we've generally kind of been a bit belligerent against it, but we've decided we're going to start investing some time in this. So if this is something that you find interesting for your conference, for your lug or whatever, then follow the instructions on that page and get in touch with us. So that's
okay,
it.
Okay, so
see you in 2 weeks' time.
We'll see you soon.